Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we talk about a drug in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
It is part of an effective package for preventing HIV in people who are healthy. We know actually that this works because it's worked very well in infants who have mothers with HIV.
Plus, all about miscarriages.
There are many factors that lead to miscarriage. Some of them are endocrine factors, some of them are immunological factors, and some of them are factors related to abnormalities in the uterus or the lining of the uterus.
And a nutritionist teaches us about nutrition and healthy weight.
Really, what it comes down to is eating fewer calories than you burn through physical activity.
We'll cook up some healthy eats and hear from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn about the why and when of miscarriage and the emotional toll it can take, plus a reality check on how to determine a healthy weight for you. But first, a new drug in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Well, doctors now have another weapon against HIV/AIDS in their arsenal, and it's a potent one. For the first time, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has approved a drug treatment that will prevent infection in healthy people. And here with more on this is Dr. Elizabeth Reddy. She's assistant professor of medicine specializing in infectious diseases at Upstate Medical University and the medical director of Upstate's designated AIDS Center Clinic. Welcome, Dr. Reddy. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there is a new FDA-approved drug, and it can help prevent the spread of HIV. That is really significant news. You actually came in here and talked about this at one point, I think right when it was in the process of being approved. Tell us again, for those listeners who may not have heard you, what is this drug and what is the hope for it?
Sure. So the medication that's been approved is called Truvada. And Truvada is actually a combination of two different medications that were initially and still are used to treat HIV. But the medication Truvada by itself is not enough to treat HIV. You need more medications in order to treat. But it is part of an effective package for preventing HIV in people who are healthy, as you've said. So what this is called is actually something called PrEP. And what PrEP stands for is pre-exposure prophylaxis. So that means that you're taking a medication to prevent HIV before getting it. And so we know actually that this works because it's worked very well in infants who have mothers with HIV. And so mothers taking HIV medications during pregnancy has been dramatically effective in preventing infection in their children. And so this is one of the ways that we initially realized that this concept could work.
So they would have to take this drug, Truvada, on a daily basis. And it's supposed to be employed alongside other risk reduction measures. In other words, so that safer sex, for example, and regular HIV testing in addition to using the Truvada. And this is, let's talk about who those people are.
I mean, okay.
Who would be most likely candidate for using Truvada?
So one of the things that we have to recognize with HIV is that there are certain groups within the U.S. that are at highest risk. That having been said, anybody who has unprotected sex can be at risk for HIV, and that's one of the reasons why we're trying to expand HIV testing to filter out to all primary care clinics.
So let me interrupt you there for a minute. So that includes both heterosexual and homosexual activity.
That's right. So really the goal for HIV testing now is that everyone should have an HIV test once in their life, and that we should not be making assumptions on who is at risk, because sometimes it's difficult to reveal all your risk factors, and also sometimes we just don't know, because sometimes there's a random encounter that ended up resulting in HIV infection.
But who is at highest risk? I mean, there are obviously key populations besides this broad brush approach.
There are, and this is the reason why we're trying to focus somewhat with PrEP. So in our country, the two highest risk populations are men who have sex with men and also African Americans, both men who have sex with men as well as heterosexual people within the African American population. For African Americans, there are particularly high risk areas within the country, so pockets that are higher risk, especially the Southeast, Washington, D.C. And for men who have sex with men, it really covers the full U.S. So we know that in 2011, of all of the men who've ever had sex with men who tested for HIV in the U.S., 18% were found to be infected. And that's really a high number, and it rivals some of the percentages that we see in other parts of the world that are considered to be heavily affected by HIV. So if you're part of that group, then your risk is much higher from what otherwise might not be considered such risky behavior.
So getting back to this, what about one other group I think of is like female sex workers? At one time, they were designated or highlighted as another potential high-risk group. Does that remain true?
That remains true. Yeah, that's absolutely
so true. They would be people who should consider or might consider using it.
Yeah.
When this whole approval process was going on, there was some controversy that was stirred up around the approval of Truvada. Let's talk about what were some of the concerns that came up then.
Sure. I think the biggest concern has been that in advocating Truvada, are we at the same time advocating people having unprotected sex, essentially? So we know that Truvada, if you take the pill daily, reduces the risk of HIV infection among men by up to 90% and potentially even more. But does that somehow give people a leeway to say, gosh, I don't even really need to use a condom because now I'm protected against the scariest disease that can be transmitted through unprotected sex, and that's HIV.
So a false sense of security, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
and therefore maybe more risky behaviors, not using safe sex methodology.
Right, that has been a concern. I think there's a couple important points to make about that concern. One is that when we see folks for appointments related to PrEP, we really go through an individualized risk history with them. And of course, we do counsel them on the importance of using condoms. It's absolutely really, as a provider, our role to make sure that people understand that condoms still should be optimally a part of a prevention package in most cases. But I think it's also important that as part of the whole PrEP picture, we do regular assessments, so regular testing for sexually transmitted infections. So what we're seeing actually amongst a number of patients who have initiated PrEP is that at their first appointment, we find that they're testing positive for other sexually transmitted infections. And they are treated appropriately, which prevents the spread in the community. And then in addition, every 3 months, they're retested. So every 3 to 6 months. And we wait to give the prescription until we've seen the patient, done the full appointment, got all of the results back. And so ultimately, I think despite these concerns, really, a lot of folks wouldn't be coming in for healthcare, and now they are. And so we've raised the ability to actually identify this kind of thing.
So you have a more rigorous, in a way, a more rigorous opportunity to evaluate these people and keep them functioning, using proper methodology. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with AIDS specialist Dr. Elizabeth Reddy. We're talking about the new drug to help prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS. So let's get to why are we trying to do this? I mean, what's the bottom line? What's the motivation for having Truvada made now available to the general population?
So the goal in the U.S. is to really finally decrease the number of new infections for HIV. So what we've seen is a steady rise in the number of people living with HIV in the U.S. because we have much more effective treatments, and we still continue to see new infections. And we have made some headway so that the rate of increase is much less than it used to be, and yet we still have new infections. So New York State has taken a very aggressive approach and really promoted the use of PrEP as part of a package towards reducing the new infections of HIV in our state. And the goal in New York is to go from an average of 3,000 to 4,000 new infections per year all the way down to less than 750. And if we can do that, then once you reach a certain point in an epidemic where you have few new infections, it actually has a broader effect on the larger population and makes it the epidemic begins a steadier decline because there's less people coming in contact with
the infection. So you're kind of curbing the increase.
That's the goal.
I mean, you're stopping the increase and thereby curbing the whole epidemic.
Exactly.
And is there some thought that this then would be taken on a worldwide basis? I mean, obviously you're talking about a local and a New York State effort. And then, of course, it would probably need to go national. Or how is this working, actually, nationally at this point?
That's a great question. The CDC has advocated the use of PrEP in the United States, and it has steadily increased in uptake, especially within the last year. There's really been a lot of attention given to the potential for PrEP, as well as with newer options for health insurance. There are more options or more availability of people accessing health insurance.
Yes, so health insurance will cover it in most cases.
It will.
That's a huge factor right there.
It is, absolutely. So we've seen a steady increase in the United States. Abroad, there have been some more challenges. It was optimally a goal to be used abroad, but the ability of people to take the medicine on a daily basis abroad has been more difficult, specifically among women who have been studied in Africa. Why that is, we're really not sure.
So you don't know whether there are prejudices or ignorance, or so it's an education process as well as an availability or an access issue.
Absolutely.
So are there any side effects to PrEP? Are there any reasons why people shouldn't take it?
Great question. For the most part, Truvada is extremely well tolerated. It has no side effects in most people. For the first couple weeks after you start taking it, some people will experience mild things like headache, nausea that usually go away. The one potential concerning side effect with Truvada is for anyone who has kidney problems. It's not recommended depending on the problem that they have. And there is a very rare, so about 1 in 1,000 risk of developing kidney problems on Truvada. And so we do monitor kidney function on people who have started the medication, and that's part of the regular follow-up that someone would undergo, so that really the risk of a serious problem is extremely low.
So it works. I mean,
it's very well.
It's quite effective. But I think we need to make clarify this one point. Does it actually cure AIDS, or does it simply prevent you from contracting HIV?
Yes, it definitely just prevents you from contracting HIV. And it's also really important that anyone who's coming in for PrEP also have an evaluation to make sure they don't already have HIV. Because if you do have HIV, it needs to be treated with more than just Truvada.
So where can it be accessed in central New York? I mean, where can someone get this drug right now if they were so interested? As you talked about the general populations, but also these high-risk populations, where could they get the drug?
So for now, we at the Designated AIDS Center Clinic are the only clinic that we're aware of that is offering this medication. However, we know there are other primary care providers that are interested in starting to offer. So I think asking your primary care doctor if you're interested would be a great first step. And we're also accepting referrals. You can call us at 464-5533. That's the Upstate DAC clinic.
That's in the 315 area code.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that. And we're definitely accepting new patients, and we'd be happy to get a referral.
And where are you located?
We're in the Krause Physicians Office Building on Irving Ave. Across from Krause Hospital in Syracuse.
Right, but you are an Upstate Designated AIDS Center Clinic.
Correct. We're affiliated with Upstate, but we also, we house with Krause.
Okay, well, thanks so much for coming in. Excuse me, this has been very, very important and interesting information. My guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Reddy. She's assistant professor of medicine at Upstate Medical University, specializing in infectious diseases, and she's the medical director for Upstate's designated AIDS Center Clinic. Next up, all about miscarriage and the emotional toll it can take. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen joining you. Miscarriage has never been easy. And with more and more women having babies later in life, postponing motherhood due to career paths, many are also seeking reproductive help, making the stakes even higher. We'll hear with more on all of this is Dr. Shaki Badaway, Professor and Director of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. And Kathleen Dermody, Certified Nurse Midwife, also from Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for both to both of you for coming in. Dr. Badaway, let me start with you. Give me a medical definition of miscarriage. What is it exactly?
Yes, miscarriage is loss of a pregnancy before viability. Most of these cases occur in the first trimester or 3 months, but up to 20 weeks, it is still considered to be a miscarriage.
And why do they occur? Do we know?
There are many factors that lead to miscarriage. Some of them are endocrine factors, some of them are immunological factors, and some of them are factors related to abnormalities in the uterus or the lining of the uterus.
Like someone having cervical insufficiency, for example, the ability to hold
cervical
pregnancy.
Insufficiency is one, but also they could have a septum in the uterus. They could have a bicornuate uterus.
So the shape of the uterus.
The shape of the uterus.
What's going on in the uterus.
Or they could have also a lesion inside the uterus, like a submucous polyp or a submucous fibroid, a small there, interfering with the implantation process, and therefore miscarriage happens.
How about things like infection? Do you ever see that as playing a role
yes.
as well?
Yes, infection plays a big role because it could infect the sac. It could infect the lining of the uterus, and in both situations, the pregnancy cannot stay.
How about underlying conditions? Like if a person is diabetic or has thyroid disease or has undergone or severe kidney disease, for
right.
example.
Right. We stated, number one, metabolic and endocrine problems. For example, diabetes, which is uncontrolled, severe hypertension that's uncontrolled, kidney problems that are uncontrolled, we look into all these factors. In addition, thyroid disease, both low thyroid and high thyroid.
Hypo and hyper.
Hyper, all of them interfere, and that's part of the workup that the physician will undergo in the process of management of this situation.
How about lifestyle factors? Things like smoking and alcohol. We've often heard that you can have an alcohol fetal alcohol syndrome, that's after a baby is actually developing and born. But does it have an impact even on the pregnancy?
Yes, it has a very serious impact, especially smoking, drinking too much. All these have a negative effect, and that's why in counseling those patients, we see if they are smokers, we try to get them out of smoking habits to decrease as much as possible the intake of the alcohol. And so that is part of the problem, of course.
What percentage of people who have miscarriages have them because of a chromosomal abnormality? In other words, the pregnancy wasn't right to begin with.
Chromosomal abnormalities lead to about 50 to 60% of the pregnancy losses.
So that's a majority.
It's the majority of the miscarriages are due to that. And of course, As the woman grows older, these chromosomal abnormalities will be higher.
That's what I was going to ask you. With so many more women putting off, you know, getting pregnant because they have career aspirations and education and long paths to get to where they want career-wise, they're waiting longer and longer to have their first babies.
Exactly.
Are you seeing an increase in miscarriages secondary to that?
Well, first of all, there is increase in infertility. They are unable to achieve pregnancy as easy as they were in the 20s or 30s for the same reason, because the egg is, so to speak, old and liable to these chromosomal abnormalities. And therefore, when fertilization happens and pregnancy happens, then this pregnancy, in the majority of cases, is going to be ending in a miscarriage or an abnormality.
So you definitely see a higher rate in these in older women. Kathleen, how does someone know that they're having a miscarriage? What are some of the signs and symptoms?
Women often will notify their healthcare provider that they're having, that they've, number one, had a positive pregnancy test, and that they may be having symptoms of cramping or spotting. Sometimes it can occur as a delayed period when they're not sure when their cycles are. Many women have irregular cycles.
And in that case, it just kind of happens and they don't even necessarily pay attention to it?
Well, they may not be aware of their cycle regularity.
I mean, that they may not even know they have been pregnant,
That's
for
correct.
Example.
Right. But I would say for the vast majority of women, especially the population that Dr. Badaway is referring to, they know the moment they became pregnant. They know when that pregnancy test was positive. And often they've had a sonogram. So they may feel cramping. Sometimes it's a normal cramping, but they're on a heightened state of alert. Because of the risk of the pregnancy. So they may...
And there's blood as well.
They may see some blood, some spotting. It may be very heavy. It may be light. So it's very individualized.
So Dr. Badaway, how is it diagnosed? How do you know? I mean, when is the spotting normal or okay during a pregnancy? And when is it a sign of a miscarriage?
When a woman comes to me and says, well, my pregnancy test is positive, and I have been spotting or bleeding, some cramping, as Kathleen mentioned, we get the patient and we ask her about factors, what she taking, vitamins, she drinking, smoking, diabetic, alcoholic, whatever. And then after that, we get to the exam, put her on the exam table, put the speculum in, look at the cervix.
So you do a pelvic exam.
Right.
That's the gold standard, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes, to see if the cervix is dilated, any products of conception coming out or no. And then we always do a sonogram to look at the sac, pregnancy sac, and to the embryo, and whether there is fetal heart or no fetal heart, and we'll take it from there.
So if a person, I guess the question is, if you were to find that the person has these other underlying conditions like being diabetic or hypertensive or something of that nature, what's the treatment? What do you do at that point if the person has actually had a miscarriage? What's the next step?
Then if the miscarriage happened and she has all these predisposing factors, then we get her to the treatment phase. Diabetic, then she has to be evaluated for diabetes and be treated until the blood sugar gets to be normal. Same with high blood pressure, to be given the specific medications. Always we ask for consultants, of course, to treat the diabetes and treat the hypertension and all that to be within the normal range before she achieves another pregnancy.
So you basically need to correct...
Correct.
Whatever these underlying conditions have done.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with obstetrician-gynecologist Dr. Shaki Badaway and Kathleen Dermody. She's a certified nurse midwife. We're talking about miscarriage. So, Kathleen, I think that more and more these days, especially in this population you've been talking about, who are the older women, mm-hmm. who may have put off getting pregnant, who are prizing this pregnancy and may actually have even had to have some reproductive assistance of some kind, there's got to be a very powerful emotional component to this miscarriage. Tell us about that.
There's a tremendous emotional impact on women and their families. As Dr. Badaway referred to, you know, often women have spent a great deal of time, emotional, physical time, maybe a great deal of financial investment in this pregnancy achievement. Even those who haven't, the moment that pregnancy test is positive, that woman is bonded. So the length of gestation is irrelevant. If a woman has been trying for 3 years to get pregnant, then that's essentially a 3-year gestation. So as healthcare providers, it's critical that we recognize the importance of this event for women and give them the appropriate support that they require and also help their families to support them.
So what are the kinds of things that you're engaged in? Because I know you have all kinds of efforts that you've been making to help women facing this.
Recognizing the event and the significance of the event is critical. If you consider where miscarriage usually leads a woman, as Dr. Badaway said, sometimes very heavy bleeding, a woman may end up having a D&C, which is a surgical procedure. A surgical unit is not necessarily a very supportive unit. They have other priorities. So we're making efforts in the community to outreach surgical centers, different offices with information on bereavement, talking to healthcare providers about how to relate to women, and often just recognizing that this is an important event.
It's a loss.
It's a loss.
Which I think too often becomes kind of ignored or...
That's right. Invisible.
Yeah.
Right. And it is invisible to many folks. And, you know, teaching a family to just say, I'm sorry, or recognizing the pain that this woman is experiencing is an excellent first step in helping her. In the hospital setting, we have cards on doors that we that give a visual cue that this mom has experienced a loss. So that lets other healthcare providers, different services that she might have contact with, know that the tenor of this room has changed. You know, this is a mom and a family that has experienced a loss. We give moms mementos. It's very important to recognize the importance of this event in her life. And sometimes that means fingerprints, if they're available, maybe hair samples. We have a memento box that we, if certainly not with miscarriages because the fetus is too small, but in an older gestation.
Like a stillbirth.
Like a stillbirth, right. Generally after 20 weeks, we may dress them and take photos. There's a group, Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, provides beautiful photos. We give them a memento box. I brought one in here to show you. And, you know, it's a moms leave with something. And that's a really important thing. Many of the funeral directors in this area donate services. It's quite a supportive service. There are volunteers who knit and sew these beautiful little 3- and 4-inch outfits for our babies.
That's really heartwarming.
Yes.
That really is. Dr. Badaway, what is the likelihood of getting pregnant after a miscarriage?
It could be easy or it could be difficult. You know, as continuation to what Kathleen mentioned, many of these patients come after the miscarriage to discuss their future fertility and so on. And they sit in the office in front of you and they start crying. They are stressed. They are saddened. Sometimes they have the feeling of blaming themselves. But they are not to be blamed. Miscarriage happened.
Of course not. Yes.
And if there is an etiology, that should be treated. So if there is a stress factor and sadness continue, of course, they will never forget that for their life. They will always
remember.
That's
a real loss is what you're
saying.
That doesn't
loss.
Go away.
And it doesn't go away. And it's our duty to ease things around them and explain the facts so they know the facts and they live with these facts. They know that they are not to be blamed. It's something mm-hmm. that happened because of a reason.
So taking time to heal physically and emotionally is probably important.
Very important.
But is there a medical concern for how long you should wait? I mean, is there a medical time frame?
No. If the patient is ready to get pregnant, she should get pregnant. In the old days, they used to say, well, you have to wait 3 months. Nobody knew
it
why. For
right.
what reason.
Right. Right.
So there is no reason. I think the sooner they get pregnant, the better, because they have mm-hmm. a pregnancy to take care, provided that we did the evaluation mm-hmm. and we corrected.
Eliminated any mm-hmm. of the factors.
Any factors.
Thank you so very much. We have just a minute or two left.
1 second. I'd like to just mention that it's critical in this next pregnancy, if a woman's able to achieve it, that she's at high risk for depression, stress, anxiety. So care providers need to be on heightened alert. She's not just a worry ward. She's a mom that's experienced a loss.
That sounds very important for us all mm-hmm. to remember. Thank you so much. My guests have been Dr. Shaki Badawi, Professor and Director of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University, and Kathleen Dermody, Certified Nurse Midwife, also from Upstate. Thanks so much. I'm very pleased to have you here. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on AIM. And now, some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine, Dr. William Paolo, tells us what we need to know about frostbite.
As the weather turns colder, we begin to worry about frostbite. Frostbite we particularly see as you enter the cold and the extremities that are away from the heart stop getting as much blood flow as they should as the body tries to keep blood to its vital organs. What we find that you should do to prevent this from happening is, number one, dress in layers. To keep your feet and your toes warm, you actually have to keep your core warm. In order to do that, you want to dress in layers so that the body doesn't start constricting the blood vessels in your fingers and your toes. Frostbite can be divided really into three phases. There's what we call frost nip, or first-degree frostbite, which is really just a freezing of the skin above the extremity. In addition, you can have second degree, where you start involving some of the fat and layers beneath, and then you can get third degree when it goes all the way down to muscle and bone. You can recognize frostbite by, number one, a painful or numbing feeling to the extremity that may change colors from either white to red. Number two, you can start seeing darkness if you leave it in cold for very long, because you can actually start losing blood flow to that extremity. If you do have signs of frostbite or frost nip, rubbing is not the answer. Your body actually can form little crystals in there, and they can be sharp and jagged, and rubbing it can actually cause more damage to the tissues underneath. We recommend rewarming of one of two ways: either passively rewarming by moving into a hot area, getting near a fire, or what we call actively rewarming, which is by running your extremity that has been exposed to the cold under warm or tepid water in order to actively rewarm that site. Again, in order to prevent it, the best way is to not expose and to stop the cold from happening in the first place. So wear your gloves in the car, and then when you leave your car, you keep your gloves on so that your hands are not cold to begin with, or your feet are not cold to begin with. Dress in warm layers, and things like cotton socks, because they promote sweating, do not seem to work very well to keep you warm. Moisture wicking socks, wool, and natural fiber seems to keep your extremities warmer. So those are just some tips to avoid the cold.
Up next, how to determine what's a healthy weight for you. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on AIM. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on AIM. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of March 8th. Stress less for a healthy heart. When your body is stressed, it releases the hormone adrenaline, which increases your heart rate, breathing, and blood pressure. A faster heart rate and higher blood pressure can make your heart work harder and can weaken your artery walls if these symptoms persist over time. This week, investigate your stress levels and heart disease risk factors. If you often exhibit type A behaviors, like feeling rushed, impatient, irritated, angry, or hostile, then focus on reducing the frequency of these behaviors to stay heart healthy. In other words, try to de-stress. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. With all the emphasis on weight in this country, one of the most common questions people ask is, how much should I weigh for my age and height? In other words, how do I determine my ideal body weight? We'll hear with more on this is Christy Trumbo, registered dietitian and nutritionist at Upstate's Community Campus. Welcome, Christy. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So many people struggle with this question. I mean, one person's ideal body weight may be completely different from another's. For example, if you are around people in a family who are very overweight, you might think, well, I'm just right. If I'm not quite obese. And the other way is, if you're comparing yourself, for example, to a fashion model, you might feel, I'm way, way too overweight. So what do you recommend for people in terms of really establishing what is a reasonable body weight for your age and height?
Sure. There's something that we use. It's called the body mass index. And basically, it's based on your weight, and it's based on your height. And if you want to know what your body mass index is, you can ask your doctor. They would have a good idea of that. Or there's a lot of really, there's free tools where you can use a body mass index tool online. You can go to the cdc.gov and they have it there. But an underweight body weight is under 18.5 as your body mass index.
So if you have a BMI of less than 18.5, you're considered underweight.
Mm-hmm. Normal is 18.5 to 25. Overweight is 25 to 30, and obese is greater than 30.
Now, as I was reviewing for this, it struck me that several of the health professionals I came across said that the body mass index is the best way to calculate in terms of whether your body weight is ideal. But some say that it's a little faulty, that it doesn't tell the whole story, because I guess there are several factors you need to include, including age, muscle fat ratio, of course the height and weight, but even your sex or your bone density. So how do you wrap all of those together with the BMI and come up with this concept?
Sure. I mean, if you were to take a bodybuilder, they may be considered overweight, but they could be healthy. So I think we need to look at other indicators such as lab values. We need to talk about medical conditions such as diabetes, you know. Basically, what insurance companies use is the body mass index, because the higher your body mass index, the more at risk you are for certain conditions, such as type 2 diabetes, such as heart disease, stroke, certain types of cancers, osteoarthritis, even pregnancy complications. So we use body mass index because, like I said, the higher you are with your body mass index, the more at risk you are with these types of medical conditions.
So it's kind of a rough ballpark basic standard that we've come upon. But the truth is, there are these other factors that play a role. For example, as you said, bone density would affect your weight. And you might be very strong, and you might be a bodybuilder, and you're obviously not overweight at that point.
Sure.
So those are all, you really need to look at a lot of these different factors.
Yeah, and you can ask your doctor, you know, what they think and where they want you to be at as far as your weight. That would be something that you could bring with, you know, that question to your doctor.
And as you said, there are a lot of these kinds of calculators online.
Mm-hmm.
There are places to go where you could just take a look at it so you know where you stand.
Right. The cdc.gov, they have a BMI tool. And a registered dietitian or your doctor could help you figure out your BMI as well.
And so do you rely on that when you're counseling
patients?
We
use the BMI a lot for insurance purposes. I work specifically with bariatrics, so to qualify for bariatrics, you have to have above a BMI of 35 with certain comorbidities such as type 2 diabetes, sleep apnea, and then over 40 of a BMI to qualify for bariatric surgery.
And
so we definitely use BMI.
So you're considered morbidly obese at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But the average Joe or Jane, so to speak, do you think it's important for them to understand what their BMI is so that they can have this sense of where their target should be?
Sure, yes.
Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with registered dietitian and nutritionist Christy Trumbo. We're talking about how to determine what is your most healthy weight. So, you know, we're talking now about kind of statistics, but in terms of health, I mean, what you said is that when you're in the higher BMIs, they seem to run along with these kinds of disease entities. Right. But it's not always the case.
No, it's not always the case.
So it's not a given. It's not a complete story. Mm-hmm. It's only a piece of the story.
Exactly.
So once you've determined, let's say you've determined what should be your ideal weight, what is the best plan for getting there? I mean, that's the problem. I'm sure you face it every day with your clients.
Right. So it's clear that we know that shedding pounds, it's a smart thing to do, but there's a lot of weight loss products out there. There's a lot of diets and fad diets, medical supplements. It can be really confusing. But basically, a lot of the times what really it comes down to is eating fewer calories than you burn through physical activity.
So is it that simple? You know, all through the years we've heard all kinds of theories about, you know, weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
But is it that simple as just, you know, calories in, burning calories out?
Yes.
It's really that simple.
It is that simple. Yep. And a registered dietitian can figure out your specific calorie needs, and that's based on your age, it's based on your gender, your height, and your weight.
So those same factors that we were talking about for BMI actually do play a role in then determining how much in the way of calorie intake you should have.
It's a different calculation. BMI is a different calculation.
Yes.
And then we'll use some of those things for another calculation based on, you know, those factors.
But are there other variables that play a role? For example, if you have a fast metabolism, you know, you always hear, oh, they have a very fast metabolism. They burn through everything they eat. And there are other people who are they say, you know, they could eat almost nothing and they, you know, everything goes to fat.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience?
As you age, your metabolism does slow down because we lose muscle mass. And the more muscle, like men generally have more muscle than women. So that's why men generally tend to have a higher metabolism than women. So that is a factor that does play a role.
So when you counsel people, is there some way to jumpstart your metabolism? That's another piece of kind of hype
exercise.
Out there.
Exercise is wonderful.
So exercise would be...
And making sure you're not skipping meals.
So let's,
protein.
Okay, so let's go through one of the other points I want to emphasize, which is something we talk about all the time here, is this notion of diet. You said there's all these diets out there.
Right.
Some of them, we use the term diet to mean just what you eat. Others have to do with a restrictive diet.
Sure.
What's your feeling about this whole notion of weight loss diets?
I tell my patients to throw that diet word, the D word, out the window. I don't like it because it's temporary. And my approach is lifestyle. This is a lifestyle change. And it's, you know, you want, when you're trying to follow a healthy meal plan, you want to find something that's not restrictive. You want to find something that fits into your daily lifestyle because that's something you're going to follow through the rest of your life.
So you're trying to develop a new normal.
Right.
And one that you can sustain.
Correct.
Because this whole notion of that's why I think so many people have this roller coaster ride with weight, because they try to go on a diet, maybe they'll drop significant amounts of weight, but before you know it, they're back to their old eating habits and they're back up again and then they start all over again.
So I usually focus with making small changes. So for instance, if you generally drink 3 cans of soda every day, I'll tell my patients, maybe let's do 1 can a day and try to drink more water, as opposed to eliminating soda altogether. So you're not so restrictive or trying.
Because it backfires?
Yes, it does. You don't want to feel deprived.
Are the sugary drinks a big factor?
They're extra calories. They're empty calories. So yes.
So getting back to what you should do, let's start with what some of the basic concepts are. So to lose weight, to be successful, they have to change their habits, and they have to really think of it as a new normal. So you started to say exercise. So tell us more about how much exercise, what kind of exercise, what's realistic for people?
Sure. 30 to 60 minutes 5 times a week. And that could be something such as walking. Walking is great. And it doesn't have to be 30 minutes all in one time. if you want to break it up, because sometimes 30 minutes can seem very overwhelming. So if you want to do 10 minutes of a walk or an exercise DVD in the morning before you go to work, 10 minutes on a lunch break, and 10 minutes after dinner, that's equally as efficient.
I think that, and is it equally as effective as well?
Exactly.
Wow. I think we've talked about that on other shows we've done, but that's always something that I think people don't really get a handle on. That as long as you stay active, mm-hmm. even if you do it in small, you know, portions, you can. That's as good.
Right, and you want to find something that you like, such as a lot of people love Zumba, water aerobics. If you have, you know, leg issues, you have joint issues, if you really have a hard time moving around, water aerobics, water Zumba, that's a great place to start. Or even sitting down in a chair and getting some cans of soup, some water bottles, and doing some upper body exercises.
So you want to modify whatever your needs are to
exactly.
keep the exercise
yeah.
going.
Mm-hmm.
How about things like screen time? You know, in today's world, we are so overwhelmed with our devices. I mean, there's nowhere you can go where you don't look around, and people don't look at each other, they're looking at their screens.
Mm-hmm.
How does that impact on weight?
Yeah, the more that we're sitting down and we're sedentary, then we're not burning calories. So if you can try to limit your screen time to under 10 hours, you know, a week, then that would be great. So TV time, computer games, so then you're moving more.
So people who have computers as part of their work life really need to pay attention to the fact that they need to get up and move even somehow through the day.
Right.
So that they don't become, as you said, couch potatoes or sedentary.
Yeah, I mean, even just taking the stairs instead of the elevators at work, if you're going down to the cafeteria or parking far away, you know, in a parking lot, those are all different ways of trying to incorporate exercise into your day, everyday routine.
What about portion control?
Sure.
That's something they talk about. I've heard talked about all the time. And I think there's a lot of misinformation about what is an average or what is a healthy portion.
Mm-hmm. It's smart if you're trying to watch your portions to use smaller utensils. Smaller plates, maybe a toddler plate, may help because visually you feel like you're getting more when you're trying to cut back on the foods you're eating. And using smaller utensils such as toddler spoons and forks, so you're taking small bites, and you're slowing down at your meals. Your meal time should ideally be 20 to 30 minutes long. And sometimes that's hard to do. So using those smaller utensils can help with that. And on your plate, you want to try to fill up half of your plate of fruits and non-starchy vegetables. The other one quarter of your plate should be lean protein. And the other one quarter of your plate, any type of a grain, specifically whole grain, if possible. And then your low-fat dairy.
So if you have that balanced approach and smaller portions, that generally you're really doing just what you need for your body.
Exactly. You're getting in all of your food groups. You're getting in your nutrients. You're getting in a good amount of fiber and protein to provide you with satiety. You're getting some good calcium for your bones. So it's all those really great food groups.
And so do you really believe in this idea of not skipping breakfast? Is that important?
What I find is that when you're skipping breakfast, then you're trying to make up for it later in the night. So people are eating at 10, 11 o'clock at night, and that's when we're more sedentary. So if you try to get those three meals a day and get it in earlier in the day, then hopefully you don't feel the need to snack later on at night.
So three meals a day still is basically the watchword.
Yes.
So yep. This idea of spreading it out through the day in small little amounts isn't as good as the three meals.
Well, there's certain conditions such as hypoglycemia, some diabetics, they may need a snack in there. And that's something you could talk with your doctor or registered dietitian. But ideally, those three meals a day, like that plate method I mentioned, would be ideal if you don't have any types of medical conditions.
My guest has been Christy Trumbo, registered dietitian and nutritionist at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. The death of a parent often means an accounting on the part of a child. That dramatic absence of a major force and influence can be quite complicated by the reservoirs of past experiences the death brings forth. Oakland, California poet Claire Scott beautifully illustrates this dangerous balancing act in her poem called No Need. No need to please him anymore. I can blast Simon and Garfunkel with impunity. Hello, darkness, my old friend. No need to skip sweets, sleep 8 hours, watch educational TV, lions in the Serengeti mostly yawning, or coarse-haired aardvarks in a country I never heard of in North Africa, near Cambodia. I've come to talk to you again. No need to listen to Pavarotti sing E Luce Van La Stella for the 50th time, knowing he will be shot for the 50th time. No need to speak with perfect grammar, avoiding I feel badly, or I wish he was, because a vision softly creeping. Certainly no need to run 5 days a week, keeping score of yourself versus yourself, hoping to win. Left its seeds while I was sleeping. I can eat lemon meringue pie at 8 a.m., dipping and licking sticky sweetness, rubbing fingers on my pants, skip the gym, nap till 2, lounge all afternoon in striped pajamas, grab chocolate as needed, breaking bad reruns till 4 a.m., glasses of wine, who's counting? I don't. And the vision that was planted in my brain, he's like an incurable disease colonizing me, microbes spreading, duplicating their genetic message. It doesn't seem to matter that his ashes are scattered near the roads he ran. Still remains. He speaks to me across ethereal space from deep inside, my father, within the sound of silence.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn about the bionic pancreas, plus a new study to unlock the secrets of Alzheimer's disease, and a medical mission bringing sight to a third world country. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.